Anthony Reich, a very, very good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning, Booker. Tov, very good, thanks. How are you guys doing today, Howard?
Yes, excellent, thank you. I mean, we are getting a little bit of pushback from our listeners. I don't know why, but there you have it. All in a day's work. The idea
isn't that their job, Howard?
Yeah, I thought it's my job. You know, anyway.
No, you do your job very well, but I think they need to respond in some way.
Yeah, no, I think you're quite right about that. You wouldn't want me getting away with anything. The IDF attacked targets in the Gaza Strip yesterday. And that was soon after a rocket launched from Gaza landed in Israel territory. What would have been the reason now for this launch of this rocket?
It's not clear. Not clear. And we don't really know who was responsible for the launch of this rocket. And once again, it kind of gets very, very minimal press coverage. It seems to be kind of concealed somewhere in the little bits. Nothing too serious, you know, all in a day's work. Nothing really out of the usual, which is a sad statement, I think, in itself, because rockets being launched from Gaza are clearly a very serious issue. And in fact, the way that the IDF responded to it was also extremely low-key. So up until now, the kind of low-key responses that we've experienced from the IDF have been, airplanes being launched by the Israeli Air Force to fire against particular targets in Gaza Strip, maybe just a few sorties here and there just to send a message. Yesterday, there wasn't even that. It was simply a tank that attacked a position in the southern Gaza Strip, and that was really the end of the response. So while the Israeli government does have this policy of not allowing any rocket fire to go without response, the response yesterday was extremely muted, to say the least. Now, the rocket that was fired landed in an open space, although it seems to have landed fairly near to some populated areas, perhaps even uncomfortably near to some populated areas. Fortunately, there were no casualties reported, no injuries, no damage reported. There were people who said that they actually heard explosions, so that the rocket really exploded and landed quite near to where they were. And there were some unconfirmed reports that suggested that, in fact, there was even another rocket that had been fired towards Israel from Gaza that actually landed within the Gaza Strip, so it didn't even cross the border. But once again, you know, this is just this is what we call in Israel moments of quiet, when you only have, you know, a rocket here and there being fired, which really doesn't do much damage. But we all know that moments of quiet like this can very, very quickly escalate into something quite serious. If that rocket had particularly hit that populated area, you know, we would have seen a much, much greater escalation. But as it turns out, it seems to me as if, though, it probably was a rocket that wasn't fired by Hamas, perhaps one of the renegade groups operating within the Gaza Strip, and hence the very muted response from the IDF. So, you know, we will obviously continue to watch things, and particularly tomorrow, which has been the Fridays, of course, have been the day for those border protests over the last few months. And we're expecting that there will be some more border protests tomorrow. And it's not clear whether this rocket fire will potentially have more of an influence over what goes on tomorrow. But I guess, you know, only time will tell.
All right, indeed it will. But it definitely does seem, the impression that I got from Israel's response was that, you know, we have to respond. We don't really want to do this, but we can't, you know, not responding will ultimately cause us more issues than responding. So therefore we're going to be doing it. Is that right?
I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's also a case of, we've said that we're going to respond and we're not withdraw. Mm. We're not going to withdraw that policy right now. So, you know, a rocket is fired, we will respond. But right. The last thing that we want is for this to escalate into something much bigger.
Yeah, one does get that sense. All right, let's talk elections. The Likud's list for the Knesset is now final after the primary. We want to talk about that. Were there any surprises? Also, a message from one of our listeners for Anthony Gantz is causing waves regarding learning lessons from disengagement from Gaza, Gush Katif, etc. You know, can we talk about that? Talk about that as well? It's one of his interviews that seemed to have ruffled some feathers.
Absolutely. So let's just talk about the Likud list. I mean, we spoke about this yesterday before all the votes had been counted up. Now all the votes have been counted up. The list is final. And I think there are a few interesting things which are worth mentioning. The first of which is, of course, that Yuli Edelstein, is in fact, the person who got the most votes in that primary. So he appears at the spot number two on the list, because of course the top spot is reserved for the prime minister who didn't submit himself for election in the primary, and that would be a usual practice. That's nothing unusual. That's not the prime minister exerting his influence and authority. That's just the way that things work. So he had the first spot reserved for him. But what was important for the prime minister beyond his own position on the list is the fact that he gets a lot of support from people who are supporters of his in the top spots on the list. So he was appealing to the Likud voters to vote for people who are very, very close to the prime minister in order to promote them to be in the top spots on the list. And I think we can see that in positions number 2, 3, and 4 on the list, which are reserved for Yuli Edelstein and for Transportation Minister Yisrael Katz and for Public Security Minister Gilad Erdan. Those three people come in the next few positions on the list, and they can really be regarded as, I don't want to use the word cronies, but certainly supporters of the prime minister who would, you know, support his position almost come what may. The next position, of course, is the interesting one, which is the one that went to Gideon Saar. He apparently was not congratulated by the prime minister, as were others on the list, after the primary, was announced yesterday. Gideon Saar is considered to be, something of a rival to the prime minister, somebody who might even rival him, for the leadership position of the Likud. So the prime minister would have considered that to be something of a problem, and yet he would have been happy that Gideon Saar didn't get a higher position on the list, because it was at one stage looking as if though he might get a much higher position on the list. So those are really the main positions that were filled, the top positions. There were some other interesting ones, that of course the next one on the list after Gideon Saar was Miri Regev. She's not necessarily university loved across Israel, but she clearly has some strong support within the Likud, and she managed to get herself a good position. The rest of the top 10 were former Jerusalem Mayor Nir Barkat, who is a newcomer, and we spoke a little bit about him yesterday, Yariv Levin, Yoav Gallant, and Gila Gamliel, as well as Avi Dichter. So those were really the top positions on the list. And a number of notable people who dropped off the list, including Oren Chazan, who was a very kind of accident-prone, scandal-prone member of Knesset in the last Knesset, and it seems as though he's unlikely to get a position in the Knesset, as well as Yehuda Glick. We know him. And the position that was reserved for the immigrant has gone to Avraham Nagis, who's of course the Ethiopian-born member of Likud, who was also in last Knesset. He didn't get enough support to be elected to the Knesset in his own right, but there are certain positions that are reserved for particular interest groups, and so he is quite likely to get a position in the Knesset again, being the first immigrant on that list. So that really summarizes the Likud list. Now, of course, our attention will turn to the other primaries and to the production of the other lists. And, of course, to Benny Gantz, who does seem, I think, to have finally, not finally, but quite quickly, run out of his honeymoon period, because, you know, there was all the support for him, the big launch. But I think now, he, with this latest interview, I think he has ruffled some feathers, not only because of his reference to the Gush Katif withdrawal, which we'll talk about a little bit about as well, but he's ruffled some feathers because he's given quite a strong indication that almost come what may, he intends to be part of the ruling coalition, and therefore, by extension, we expect that he will team up with Prime Minister Netanyahu in the next government. And a lot of people who were hoping that he would be part of the Netanyahu opposition are very, very disappointed by this, and one gets the impression that the Israel Resilience Party, headed by Gantz, may well have lost some votes as a result of this, because I think people wanted to really see him stand up to the establishment and potentially take his position as a member of the Netanyahu opposition camp, because once you have a very, very firm opposition camp and people are supporting that openly, there was a feeling that the group that comes together to oppose Netanyahu may actually succeed in defeating him. now that Gantz has made it clear that he will certainly sit in a government with Netanyahu, one gets the impression that he might have lost votes and that those lost votes may well contribute to getting Prime Minister Netanyahu re-elected again. So that's an interesting one, and a lot of people are wondering what that means. Benny Gantz did make a comment about the Gaza Strip withdrawal being run without tearing the nation apart. He seems to have had this kind of false impression that the withdrawal from Gaza was relatively smooth and that, you know, it didn't really cause waves within Israel. And he said that lessons learned from the disengagement needed to be implemented somewhere else. It's not clear where the elsewhere is and where Israel would be considering disengaging from and withdrawing people from. But clearly the damage of that was done by the Gaza withdrawal and the fact that it really wasn't handled and managed very well by the government has still left marks on Israeli society to the current day. And so that particular comment seems to have been very, very ill thought through by Benny Gantz in making such a public comment in an interview that he'd made.
Very, very interesting indeed. All right. There's just another question from one of the listeners saying the USA is buying the Iron Dome from Israel. What are the ramifications of this?
So there was a little story saying that I think one Iron Dome is going to be bought by the U.S. government. It wasn't exactly clear from the article that I read what the U.S. will be doing with this Iron Dome. I expect it probably won't be deployed along the Mexican border, but it's not clear exactly what they intend to do with it. But I think we need to recognize that the U.S. has been involved in the development of the Iron Dome, even if it's just, you know, giving money to allow Israel to carry out the research and development itself. But I do believe that there were some American companies that were even involved in, you know, undertaking some of the critical work that was put into the development of the Iron Dome. And so therefore one would imagine that it would be automatically available to the U.S. should they wish to use it. And I think that the ramifications of the Iron Dome are clear for everybody to see, even without the U.S. government necessarily buying this piece of hardware. I think the Iron Dome has spoken for itself. It's really done some amazing work. There are other countries that have also expressed interest in buying the Iron Dome. There is, of course, this little dilemma about do you sell key critical pieces of Israel's security to other countries, because there is the danger that whatever secret, whatever the secret recipe is within that might well be leaked to Israel's enemies. And so there is you know, a lot of concern and a lot of a lot of thought that's given before critical military hardware is sold elsewhere. But, you know, the Iron Dome is the Iron Dome, and I think it would make sense that any other country, including the United States, that might have a need for short-range anti-missile systems would give the Iron Dome serious consideration. I think it's proved itself in the battlefield more than once.
Very, very interesting. And science says rather Gantz than Shas in a BB government for me. All right. I don't want to let you go without asking you about this, because this to me has to be, out of all of the stories, this is one of my favorites. A falafel emoji is set to appear on our phones in the near future. Why would any?
Indeed.
What are the circumstances, Anthony, that one would use a falafel emoji?
Well, I'm not sure is the honest answer, but there has been a promotion. There has been a little piece that promotes why the person who submitted the falafel emoji thinks that it is appropriate. And this is a person by the name of Ben Clements, who submitted this already back in April of last year. And he said that the food is popular in the Middle East and North Africa, as well as being vegan, vegetarian, halal, and kosher. So it seems to appear to all the interest groups, to all the politically correct people of the world who would like to use a falafel emoji. Mm. And actually, I've seen what it looks like. It's kind of got two falafel balls. One is a slightly misshapen one, a complete one, and the other one is kind of cut in half, shows the inside of the falafel ball. I'm not quite sure why we would use it. You know, are you feeling falafel today? I'm not really quite sure why you would use it. But apparently the Unicode Consortium has approved something like 230 new emojis that are going to be released during 2019 over a period of time. There are other food ones apparently included, not only falafel, but apparently garlic, and there are some others as well. foodie ones, as well as a whole host of different new emojis that are set to appear on our screens. There's apparently going to be something like, there's a kite, a guide dog, ballet shoes, a mechanical arm and leg. And then in the foodie ones, we've got oysters, of course, non-kosher, because maybe that's a set-off against the falafel. There's going to be apparently, as I said, garlic and butter and a waffle and an ice cube. So look out for the new emojis that are set to appear on our screen soon.
I'll certainly do that. Gimple says, if you've eaten a falafel at Hakosem in Tel Aviv, you'll know exactly why they're coming out with an emoji, a falafel emoji.
There you go. You have the answer.